We want to leave about 10 minutes at the end for questions from the assembly. Because I'm sure that when we talk about conscience and amnesty, there are bound to be some misgivings and some questions. And the last thing I would like to suggest is that I have all the answers, or that there are school answers to these problems. Christians will vary depending on how they evaluate certain factors in the situation. My concern is to present some factors in the situation which are sometimes overlooked. Yesterday we talked about the morality of warfare, and a summary statement might go something like this. There is a sense in which all wars are immoral. Yet when it comes to options in our fallen existence, the choice on the part of a nation to resort to arms may be the best of a number of options, and therefore right. This is why we have a doctrine of the just war, to spell out the parameters within which political leaders can make a decision that is reasonably right in terms of moral principle. Now, we have a very strange hesitation in our society, also in our church body, to talk about just wars. Well, let me indicate that the Marxists don't have that problem. They talk about just wars. They don't mind taking over the vocabulary of our theology and perverting it. Let me quote to you two sentences from a speech by Mr. Brezhnev in March 1971 to the Soviet Parliament. Such wars of liberation are not only admissible but inevitable. The communists fully support such just wars and march in the front rank with the people waging liberation struggles. Now, he doesn't mind using this vocabulary because in his ideology there are just wars. Karl Marx has provided a certain interpretation of reality, and on the basis of that interpretation, there is such a thing as a just war. The Christian religion also has an interpretation of reality. That's one of the contributions the scriptures make. It has an interpretation which includes the knowledge of the sinfulness of man and the full dimensions of our fallen existence. Just wars may be a right choice. Then why be so defensive and apologetic? The Augsburg Confession is not, in Article 16. It talks about the responsibility and the right to wage just war, jure belare. Furthermore, the apology in Article 3, and I quote, reads, David's labors in waging wars and in his home government are holy works, are true sacrifices, are contests of God. And I make that point particularly because one of the strange developments in our day has been the curious notion that somehow a conscientious objector has a greater monopoly on righteousness than one who seriously goes out to defend his government. This is a strange perversion of right and wrong. When there is an ideology abroad in the world which blatantly and openly declares that it will enslave men, that it will reduce people to being cogs in an anthill society, we have on hand a demonic phenomenon. This ideology is determined to reduce us to less than what our Creator intended us to be. It is the characteristic of Satan to do just that, to take God's creations and distort them, caricature them, and reduce them to less than what God intends. Now, I did not cite you the biblical evidence that you have to consider when you talk about the morality of war, so let me indicate those items right now. In the Old Testament, of course, you have many stories of wars, and you have to evaluate what kind of wars these were, what their purpose was, and how they fit into God's redemptive activity. There's one interesting passage which deals with King David reprimanding Joab for killing Abner privately, and he makes the observation that it is wrong to do in peacetime what can be done in war. He's making the distinction between certain kinds of killing, and that's a point to remember in connection with the interpretation of the fifth commandment, which means thou shalt do no murder with malice aforethought. In the New Testament, we have John the Baptist's response to the soldiers who came out to ask what they should do in the light of this new thing that had come with the proclamation of John the Baptist about the kingdom of God. And he doesn't for one moment suggest that they get out of uniform and get into some other kind of profession. What he told them was to go home and quit griping about their wages, and I think that's a realistic touch. Jesus did not reprimand the centurion of Capernaum and say, look, you get out of uniform and then I'll come heal your son. On the contrary, he was led to the point of remarking that he had not found so great faith in Israel as in the case of this centurion, an officer in the Roman army. Into the biblical materials, we must also, of course, take James 4:1. Because it throws light on the nature of man, his lust, his ambition, and his greed as the source of fighting and wars. The book of Revelation describes war in heaven. Even the cosmos is bothered by that phenomenon because of the introduction of evil. And by all means, we have to introduce not only the fifth commandment, but also the fourth. Some weeks ago, I was taking a group of fourth-year men that we have who are preparing for the military chaplaincy, and one of them asked the question, how can a man filled with Christian love take part in the war of South Vietnam? I said to him, by following the fourth commandment, that's how. Because love is the fulfilling of the law. That's why we learn the Ten Commandments with Luther's explanations. We should fear and love God that we may do this and that. Love is not some vague sentiment. It has content. And the content of love, as given in the Scriptures, is the law. That's why we have it. That is the will of God. And sometimes under the Fourth Commandment, where a legitimate government issues legitimate orders, the response of love is to do just that. Let's go on now to the questions of conscience and of amnesty. Will you look at your pamphlet, first of all, because on page 7, at the bottom, there are two statements of definition. Under section 4, paragraphs 1 and 2, and we'll go on to 3 and 4. The word conscience may mean man's faculty to respond to such moral principles as transcend human existence. It is so used, for example, in the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, Article 1. When Mrs. Roosevelt introduced this declaration into the United Nations back in 1948, she pointed up to the fact that the first article says, since men are endowed with reason and conscience, they are entitled to certain rights. Every communist representative of every country under the influence of the Soviet Union got up to object. He had to be ideologically consistent, for in Marxism, conscience and reason are produced by reflex action. In our society, and this is not necessarily biblical, Conscience is used as that faculty by which the individual human being is distinguished from the rest of life, because a human being can respond to principles outside the system. He can put things together by reasoning and come to moral conclusions. Secondly, in the New Testament, it is used as a term to signify moral response in depth on the basis of conclusions reached by evaluating the ethical aspects and implications of a given issue or situation. The Old Testament does not use this word. It is covered by the general word heart. It is primarily St. Paul and St. Peter that use this term because it was current in the Roman Empire, but they give it a specifically Christian orientation. Conscience is a response to God's will in terms of having thought through the whole problem. It is not just a gut reaction. Turning the page. In other words, it stands for more than strong feeling and emotional reaction to an issue or a task. Point three is a very important one for us. A Christian is bound in conscience to disobey an order or a law which violates God's will. And that leads into the next. When a Christian is persuaded that he faces a choice in conscience, he must be certain in his own mind that his conscience is informed by principles which conform to God's will. For he has the burden of not violating his own conscience. And that takes care of the question of selective conscientious objection as far as the individual being a Christian is concerned. Paragraph 5. When he is inclined, for example, to claim for himself the right of conscientious objection to a particular war, he will first need to give serious consideration to the following matters as they relate to his responsibilities as a citizen of a particular nation. He's got to understand something about the role of government in the maintenance of order and in the defense and extension of justice and freedom. He has to have some conception of the role of military establishments in the life and tasks of a nation, the purposes of the war in question, as these relate to the foreign policy of a nation, which in our case consists of three items. Our foreign policy is built around security, development, and peace. And it's especially the development item that is of great significance today. The significance and applicability of the commandment, thou shalt not kill, the ideological ingredients of the war under evaluation, that's no mean item today. Let no one kid you that the Cold War is over. The principle that the government of a nation in its dealings with other nations has an a priori, though not unquestioned, claim on the trust of its own citizens as a source of information and direction. Now, having done this by way of general definition, let's go on to the question of conscientious objection as it confronts us today historically. It should be noted that when James Madison presented the Bill of Rights to the Constitutional Convention back in 1789, he included, under the first article, a sentence about conscientious objection. It read like this: "No person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person." That was intended to be part of Article 1. Which begins, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion." He was talked out of this. The convention was argued out of this by such people as Mr. Benson, who said, "It may be a religious persuasion, but it is no natural right, and therefore it ought to be left to the discretion of the government." And Mr. Scott, "If this becomes part of the Constitution, such persons can never be called upon for their services, nor can an equivalent be demanded." Now, these are interesting arguments. First of all, that conscientious objection is not a natural right. It may be a religious conviction. And secondly, that every citizen does owe responsibility to his government, also in the defense of his nation. And in our working of things, it is every male citizen between the age of 17 and 45 who has this particular responsibility. That's the group of people in our country to which government looks for the defense of the nation. Madison was argued out of this point, so you finally got the article as it reads. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And the next one is somewhat interesting because of the gun control talk today. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The militia of the United States consists of everybody, every male citizen between 17 and 45 years old. The problem came up again in connection with the Civil War. There, the South passed laws exempting all kinds of professions, like druggists, and it was surprising how many drugstores sprang up real quickly. The North accepted some legislation which made it possible for a person to buy someone else's service for $300. There was a specific provision for members of religious denominations that were opposed to bearing arms as a matter of their faith. Now, this becomes a rather significant item because that approach is retained for a long time. It was included in the Draft Act of 1917. It is included in the 1940 Selective Service and Training Act, where a conscientious objector is one who, by reason of religious training and belief, objects to taking part in combat. But in 1965, a case came before the Supreme Court on behalf of Daniel Seeger, and the Supreme Court made this interesting decision: whether a given belief that is sincere and meaningful occupies a place in the life of its possessor parallel to that filled by the orthodox belief in God. If so, then a man who has strong moral convictions and not necessarily a religious faith in a supreme being is entitled to the privileges of conscientious objection. Now, that's a considerable change in our history. Then in 1967, in the Selective Service Act of that year, the exemption from combat training and services was limited to one, quote, who by reason of religious training and belief is conscientiously opposed to participation in war in any form. Then came the case of John Sisson in 1969. He first raised the issue officially of selective conscientious objection as a problem in American law. That issue has not yet been decided by the Supreme Court. But let me remind you that as individual Christians, we live under the principle that if we really come to the conclusion that a certain war is wrong, then we have the responsibility to act accordingly, because we must obey God rather than men. In 1970, in the case Welts versus the United States, the Supreme Court decided that strong moral and ethical conviction is the equivalent of belief in a supreme being. The Defense Department regulation picked this up, and I quoted a sentence or two from it because this presents the current philosophy. The term religious training and belief may include solely moral and ethical beliefs, even though the applicant himself may not characterize these beliefs as religious in the traditional sense, or may expressly characterize them as not religious. The question of selective conscientious objection is before the Supreme Court. It has not yet been decided. Until that happens, it is thought to be a political question and not a religious issue. Now, what do we as Lutherans say, and how do we respond to this kind of issue? I would like to revert to something that is very characteristic of us as Lutherans. We distinguish between what Luther calls the kingdom of God's right hand, what he does in the church through the means of grace, forgiving sin, calling for repentance, and what Luther calls the kingdom of God's left hand, whereby he controls the created order which has fallen into sin. The symbol for the kingdom of the left hand is the sword. It is the figure of force and of power. The symbol for the right hand is the chalice. It is the church that has been given the job, for example, of forgiving sins. And whenever it so declares sins to be forgiven, we are told that this is binding in heaven. No government can forgive in the biblical sense. That's not its job. It belongs to a different kingdom. The rules are different. There are two sets of responsibilities in which we live as Christians. One set relates to us as church members with the operation of grace. The other relates to government, political structures, where the rules are derived from the need for civic order, for freedom, political freedom, personal freedom, peace, welfare, all that kind of thing. Now, as soon as you confuse these things, you get here. That church body. Here's the paragraph. In the interests of reconciliation and the binding up of wounds, for the sake of our freedoms and to allow our high respect for conscience in the best traditions of a strong and secure democracy, in the name of Christian love, we urge the President of the United States to grant at the earliest possible opportunity amnesty and pardon for those who, for actions witnessing to their beliefs, have been incarcerated, deprived of the rights of citizenship, or led by their conscience into exile during the course of the nation's great agony in the Vietnam War. Even worse is the one that came out of the heartland of America, Kansas City. 1972, January 13, 16, as an ecumenical witness. Remember, this is where a great many representatives of various church bodies came together to draw up certain resolutions, and I quote, "The religious community of the United States, as represented by the ecumenical witness," that's what they called themselves, "aware that the war in Indochina must be brought to an immediate end, urges the implementation thereupon of a broad, general, and plenary amnesty without any qualifications or conditions to all those men and women who have been prosecuted or face possible prosecution by civilian or military courts for any alleged offenses arising out of the war, as well as the meeting of our social responsibility to those who might refuse amnesty, to the civilian members of the resistance, and to those who have served in the military." Mind you, that's one sentence. "We urge this amnesty in order to overcome the paralyzing divisiveness of the war on our society and in order to mitigate as far as possible the tragic consequences of the war upon that generation which has been called upon to bear the heaviest existential burden of this war. We believe that amnesty will be one step toward the reconciliation of the society." Now watch this one. "But we do not believe that amnesty itself will constitute atonement of the society's responsibility for the war, nor will it be in the nature of forgiveness for any offenses, but rather an effort to give ourselves the benefit of the moral courage and idealism of the men and women of the young generation. We move on to amnesty then, in the light of these couple of declarations. I'll get to one from Lacusa very shortly. First of all, then, a matter of definition. Amnesty has to be distinguished from pardon. Pardon usually relates to the attitude of government and the action of government toward a single person, while amnesty relates to a whole class of people. Pardon forgives, cancels out a past offense. That is, it recognizes, government recognizes, the law recognizes that an offense has been committed and is ready to cancel out punishment. Amnesty extinguishes the interest of the law in the act's amnesty, so that, as the Supreme Court has said, amnesty is the abolition and forgetfulness of the offense. The word came to us out of the Greek world. The only real blanket amnesty that we know about outside of our own civil war was given in B.C. 403 to get people back into the city of Athens after some horrible years under people called the 30 tyrants. It was decreed by the Athenian Demos that all these people be brought back, that any offense of theirs would be disremembered. Today, there is talk about this kind of amnesty. It is called plenary amnesty or blanket amnesty, as in this statement from the Ecumenical Witness. It would include draft refusers, deserters, exiles living abroad, men convicted by courts-martial, people separated for less than honorable discharges, persons sentenced to prison, those who disavowed citizenship. This is the argument of the American Civil Liberties Union as represented by Henry Schwarzschild. This blanket amnesty has been recommended, and it is in your book, on the basis of the information that we have always practiced amnesty after wars. That is not a statement of fact. There is only one war after which a general amnesty was declared, and that was the war between the states. To be sure, Washington exercised his executive privileges and canceled out the offenses of people who took part in the Whiskey Rebellion. Remember those farmers that wanted more price for their barley as it went into whiskey. But that was a minor little revolt in Pennsylvania and is not a major part of our history. After World War II, President Truman appointed what was called an amnesty board. A retired associate justice from the Supreme Court, Owen Roberts, was made his chairman. And this was a very interesting experience because the Justice Roberts, first argued that there should be a blanket amnesty for all the 15,371 people involved. He was argued out of this, and he was very glad that he was. For when the cases were examined, it was discovered that more than half of the people involved were just ordinary criminals on the lam from the police. Let me quote from the World War II report. In perhaps one half of the cases considered, the files reflected a prior record of one or more serious criminal offenses. And they ranged all the way from rape to demolition of federal buildings, you name it, they were here. Many of the willful violators were men with criminal records. This amnesty board then proceeded with the practice of pardon. They took each case, examined it carefully, and then decided whether that individual was entitled to pardon or not. Finally, 7,351 people were pardoned. The rest were declared to be ineligible for amnesty because of previous criminal records. Now, with this kind of thing in mind, let's return to a fundamental conception, namely that amnesty is not a question of grace, but a question of justice. And here is where our Lutheran theology is very helpful, because justice is a pursuit of the kingdom of the left hand. This is where lawyers and courts and other people who get involved have the responsibility of weighing the individual's performance. Is he really a bona fide conscientious objector who took off to Canada for this reason or that? Or does he have a police record? Why should there be blanket amnesty for the estimated 70,000 that have fled for our country, when, if World War II records are parallel, we might have a large number of criminals involved in this escape from our country? The Lucusa Statement, which I referred to a while ago, of February 29, 1972, serves as a kind of general guide. We urge loving concern also for those who refuse to participate for reasons of conscience, including those who chose to face prosecution or to leave our land and seek refuge in another. We express our approval of new initiatives from both government and private agencies to resolve the question of amnesty and to provide services in order to facilitate re-entry into the life of our nation. In conclusion, the chief point I would want to make on this question of amnesty, if we Lutherans think about it, and as we reflect upon it, let us evaluate the issue in the light of our own theology and not necessarily accept all these pronouncements that come to us from various directions, calling for amnesty as though it were a problem in grace and not a question of justice. I would want to make the point, in addition, which I've already indicated, that the conscientious objector makes a contribution to our society. I would not want to be understood as in any way belittling a conscientious objector, but he is not the one who has a monopoly on doing right. It may just be that each one of those 43,000 men that died in Vietnam did a thing more right than a conscientious objector. If so, then the whole question of amnesty will have to be considered in the light of justice, and you will have to evaluate the performance of the individual in the light of the sacrifices that these men were willing to bring for their nation. That's why people are talking about equivalent service, if there is such a thing. 2 or 3 years at the disposal of the federal government for cleaning up ghettos, doing hospital work, and all that kind of thing. This is a question in justice. So, let me repeat the final point. Let us be Lutherans. Let's examine what we read and hear, because the gospel is being made into a new law. And one of the issues against which our confessions address themselves most eloquently is just that perversion, which you'll find in Roman Catholicism, Council of Trent, for instance, where the rest of truth is determined by the purity of the gospel, an unwillingness to make the distinction of Article 6 in the Formula of Concord, that there are two things God has revealed: the law and the gospel. Amnesty is a question under law, not of the gospel. Thank you very much. Have some 10 minutes here.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Charlemagne, for your very fine presentation and your thoughts on encouraging us to think seriously about Christian citizenship. We have time for a few questions. Is there anyone who would like to direct a question to Dr. Charlemagne? The gentleman at microphone 3.
Richard Loesch from Zion, Palmyra. Dr. Charlemagne, in your first presentation, you talked about the individual citizen and the church body mm-hmm. in relation to response toward government. In J, that's on page 5, I think you said that this was under the corporate.
Okay.
The corporate emphasis, or that the corporate body might present its wishes to the government. Is this what you had in mind?
Yes, but I didn't amplify that sufficiently, perhaps.
All right.
This is not so much a question of theology directly as a question of responsibility that the church has in this kind of society as a voluntary association in its relationship to government. It has the same responsibility that any other association has, namely to make itself heard, specifically on issues that involve morality.
All right. And now at microphone 4.
Frying from Waynesville. When you referred to what John the Baptist told the people who were in the military service, you mentioned that he told them that they should not complain about their wages. However, I haven't checked this for a variant reading. There may be a variant reading there, but I seem to recall that he told them something else, too.
Yeah, you're dead right. It also says don't exploit other people.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was wondering, does that mean that these men were given to use their position as soldiers to go out and take advantage of people, robbing them personally and so forth? Or does this do violence to no person refer to even killing somebody?
No. It refers to what often happens when there are military establishments around in an occupied country. They take advantage of the civilians in an occupied society.
The other question, it's not exactly a question. I just want to say that in my many years of teaching confirmation classes, I have found great difficulty in connecting government with the fourth commandment. I find it much easier to connect it with the fifth commandment.
Well, I was just following Luther's catechism, if you don't mind.
Of course, there is a difference in the numbering of the commandments. Maybe you both mean the same one.
He's reformed.
Okay. Microphone 2, please.
Pastor Lazel from Farmington. First of all, I'm sure that I'm expressing the opinion of all people here that we are very appreciative of this very clear and wonderful presentation of a very difficult subject. And I'm wondering, Mr. Chairman, will this matter be given over to print?
I'm not in a position to answer that question. The secretary is our scribe, and could you help us with this? Your request will be taken under advisement by Dr. Scherer's office.
And another matter, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to present on the very section 1, Romans 2. The institution of government belongs to God's kingdom of power. Its symbol, therefore, is the sword. The power of the church and of the civil power must not be confounded. I'm assuming that a great deal of confounding is being done right now with respect to the death penalty. We have people, thugs, who will go out and just murder for kicks or for a little income. And then they are brought to justice, And oftentimes churches will speak up and say the death penalty for that person is unmerciful. We are a merciful people. We ought to show kindness to that person, and so we keep them, imprison them, and offer them a television and good food and so forth, and let him be a burden to the state for the rest of his life, when that same person should be hanged by his neck till he is fully and completely dead.
Would our essayist care to respond?
May I bring in the post-dispatch at this point? When the chap who burned down the ROTC building over at Washington University came to trial and was sentenced to 5 years, it put up a great cry of mercy, for mercy, thinking that the judge had been too hard and all that sort of thing. And many a local clergyman joined in that same kind of complaint and whimpering. Yes, this is where the effect of the church, the confusion, let's say, between law and gospel, focuses and becomes articulate. Now, it's interesting that this man was released on bail, $10,000. One of the profs at Washington U invested $9,000 in that enterprise. As soon as the man got out of jail, he skipped to Canada. So one of the professors at Washington University is out $9,000. Serves him right.
All right. We have just a few more minutes. Microphone 2, and then 5, and then 3. Microphone 2.
Pastor Marshall of Glendale, you stated quite persuasively when a nation may and even must take up arms, and you made repeated references to the good that war can accomplish. It seems to me you have not fully exposed the evils of war that also are part of the whole picture. You ask, why be so apologetic about war? Among other things, I think because of the incomprehensible destruction of God's creation, on which you did not touch very much at all. The fact that in two wars, 70 million people were killed. You mentioned that communist ideology reduces man to something less than his creator intended him to be. Doesn't war dehumanize men also? The man who introduced violence or force as a way of solving problems was Cain. And when he killed his brother Abel, the Lord said, "Thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." And I believe that we have an accountability towards every man that dies in war, whether American, communist, or Vietnamese. Now, former Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Warren, deplores what he says is the great difficulty of men and nations of putting aside the fiction that war is an acceptable pathway to justice. And you didn't mention the seventh commandment at all, as at least I don't recall that you did. Thou shalt not steal, and I think this would include a matter of stewardship of property, of things. What right have we to take over fields and homes? Then you mentioned commandments, but the highest commandment you did not mention, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and so forth. And we ought to obey God rather than men. And finally, I wish you would comment a bit more on Christ saying, all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword. And what alternatives to war would you suggest?
You have only a minute or two.
I was going to say, when is what? Let me just pick up a couple of things. What I try to say is we are so apologetic sometimes about the concept of a just war. That is the point I was trying to make in our Christian tradition. We are the ones that develop the concept and have certain principles by which we try to determine whether a war is just. Marxism has picked this up and suddenly we become apologetic. It's our product. And therefore, it would seem to me we would want to stand up to, for it in terms of conviction. Jesus saying about taking up the sword, he that takes up the sword shall perish by the sword. Again, you have to distinguish between gospel and law, between individual relationships, such as are described in the Sermon on the Mount, and the responsibility that nations have. That's a completely different bag, because nations have the responsibility of security and of defense, which under the structures of law, the kingdom of the left, are good pursuits, whereas in private Christian life, they may be wrong. This is part of the distinction between law and gospel, between the two kingdoms with which we Lutherans live. I'm not so sure I remember much of the rest of it.
All right, fine. Why don't we just go on to the next? We have two more people at the microphone. I'm not sure we'll get them both in, but let's at least give it a try. Microphone 5.
The thing that I'm struggling with right now...
Your identification, please.
Tim Schnair, Youth Delegate, Cape Girardeau, Missouri. The thing I'm struggling with right now is your idea of law and gospel. I admit that you've got to separate the two, but throughout your entire presentation, I hear law way over here, gospel way over there, no connection between the two. And particularly on this question of amnesty, something that, well, you mentioned the statement on ACUSA, something I've struggled with for an awful long time. I hear you saying we could not grant amnesty because that's a question of law or a question of justice.
Yeah, it would be unjust, right.
Okay. That just doesn't hit me right because that's not what Christ did for us.
Well, you want amnesty for half criminals? Is that just?
I don't know. That's why I'm kind of mixed up about that right now. But what I'm saying is that, you know, you say the church has nothing to do with the state in a way, the way you're saying that. And I think it has everything to do with the state. I think Christ has so much to do with the world, the things that we do, the idea of justice, that sometimes we tend to separate them too well, put them in two different categories too easily. I don't know, maybe you need
well,
to...
Well, I'm just trying to follow Lutheran theology, which I buy with my whole heart. And I know your problems because the stuff that you read is all mixed up on this. This is why I made a presentation. Much of the theological material, like this ecumenical witness out of Kansas City, is dead wrong from a Lutheran point of view because it confuses grace with justice.
All right, our final speaker at microphone 3.
Mr. Chairman, do we reflect frequently enough how difficult is the position of our leaders, President Nixon, the governors of the states, and the mayors? I wouldn't want to be the president of our country under the prevailing conditions. It's true that mistakes are made. There is corruption in government. We often complain. Let's pray more for our government. Luther already long ago said that real good people for government don't offer themselves. They've got to be begged to run for office. Under God, government is one of my greatest benefactors. It protects my life and my property every day. And even if the government isn't perfect, only half good, I'd rather have a bad government than none at all. And then another thing, and that's the last thought. It's true. General Sherman said rightly, war is hell. And that's why we should often, in our church services, include the prayer, at least a couple of sentences, asking God to put a quick end to the war, if it be his gracious will.
No question, Mr. Chairman.
All right, fine. Thank you very much. The very fine attendance, which was evident throughout all of your presentations, the good attention and the many questions that... came from the floor, and I'm sure there are many more. I hope we'll give to you, Dr. Charlemagne, some indication of our appreciation to you for your very fine report on our opportunities as Christian citizens.
It's my privilege.
Thank you again.